color rendering, you know, when it goes from, it starts around 50, the chart, the range goes from 1500 Kelvin to around 10,000. As you go from 15, it's a very dark orange, and 10,000 is a very dark blue. But the usable segment of that particular road, we'll use that word from one end to the other, it starts around 2700, which is a incandescent lamp, burns to an incandescence. Let me drop. And then from there we start with the fluorescence. We start with a 3000 Kelvin, 3100 actually, which is a soft white. We go to 3500, which is the next one in line, which is a spec 35. It's a neutral bulb. Then we go to the cool white 4100. We go to the natural, which is 5000. Blue starts coming in. We go to daylight 6500. It's a 7000 as well. We don't stock that, and that's where it stops. The rest is not usable. It's just too dark. But that plays an important part also. The amount of energy you're saving, a 60-watt bulb is equivalent to about 14 watts of energy being consumed. There's so much involved, but the LEDs are surpassing those. Their majority LEDs are now dimmable. The majority of fluorescents we have presently are not dimmable. You have to have the correct dimmer to control these lamps. It has to be made conducive to the LEDs or the fluorescents. We do have a 3-in-1 dimmer now, which also incorporates the incandescence as well. Otherwise, there'd be flickering, destruction of the dimmer and the lamp. Back to you.
I got a comment here.
Okay, I think what I'm going to do, because I have a couple of LEDs in the house, I'm very happy with them. The color is nice, the brightness is there. I'm probably going to start switching over to LEDs, and over to you, Vito. I'm sorry.
Yes, Eric wants to say something. K2EJ, K2RJ, go ahead, Eric. I just want to warn you about one problem with dimmable LEDs. The way they get dimmed is not the conventional way to dim an incandescent bulb. The bulbs themselves have a little chip in it that looks for a little pulse that says what the duty cycle is. Now, here's the problem. The whole dimming system works beautifully, except that as the line voltage goes up and down, or disturbances on the line loop, the lights flicker with it. The reason for that, think about this one, is a dimmer, like Leviton, is one of the big problems that they're still really trying to solve, which is not that solvable. Because consider this, where you put a light switch, you may have just one lead that goes to the light, and one lead that goes to hot. And the only thing that you have that returns is the ground of the gem box. So therein lies a little bit of thinking, and you can figure out how they do it, and you understand why the line voltage jumps up and down the brightness changes. I'm going to make some guesses here, Eric, and that is, in the case of the old-fashioned dimmers, which could be a Variac or other kinds of circuits, a silicon control rectifier with a phase firing variable, you literally are changing the RMS voltage and the specific voltage you're sending to an incandescent bulb, and it gets dim. You send a lower voltage to a compact fluorescent tube, you might not exceed the ionization potential, and it may not go on at all. Therefore, I'm going to make a guess that the dimmer for a compact fluorescent bulb gives you the same voltage, but changes the timing. It's a pulse width modulator, is my guess. Is that even close, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW? No, that's very close. Let me give you two things to think about, though. The compact fluorescent bulbs, as opposed to the LED bulb, that basically has a little switching supply in it. Okay, it's got a transistor, it's got a coil, and it actually has a little bit of regulation for it. Most of them are just a little chip. The dimmable ones have another chip which fits in place of the one that's just a constant oscillator. So the compact fluorescent bulbs, you can vary the line voltage by a certain amount, I don't remember what, but still get the same brightness as it. If you drop the voltage past a certain point, then you're going to lose ionization voltage. In the LED, essentially what we've got to do is we've got to take 110 volts and make make some nice DC out of it. And, you know, if you use an SCR or something like that, that's changing the duty cycle to infant wave. And that's not how it works. What they do is they stick a little pulse on top of the sine wave, right? Because the chip in the LED supply looks for that, and it determines its position. That's how it determines the brightness. And what happens is the voltage goes up and down, the little control oscillator that's in the dimmer itself actually changes its rate, because they're only allowed to draw, I think, 3 milliamps, because in essence they're making the complete circuit for the dimmer itself, for its power supply, from the ground line of the box that's grounded. Whereas there might not be a neutral in that box. Yes, thank you.
Are we running into inductance of wiring and capacitance of wiring variations, Eric? Because ordinarily a incandescent light bulb, for instance, only needs a complete circuit to light, two wires, so to speak. And now you're describing where's the neutral, where's the ground, and so on. So give us a couple more words here as to what's going on. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
All right. You know, when you bought your house had, it might have had the hot lead connected to the one pin of the light bulb socket. And the light bulb socket had a wire that went to the switch, and the switch had a wire that went to the neutral somewhere. Okay? Actually, I said that backwards. You have the neutral connected to the socket, the line that goes to the switch from the bulb, and then the hot lead goes to the switch. Thank you. That's the right way. So all you needed was a switch to turn the thing on and off. You don't need ground, you don't need neutral, because the neutral is already connected to the outside of the screw and light bulb socket. Follow so far?
Yes, I do, and I'm going to rewire it. I'm going to reword it. You wire the system in such a way that when the switch is off, the whole light circuit is safe, so to speak. If you did it the other way around, if the hot lead always went to the bulb, and now you completed the circuit by completing the return by way of the switch, that would be a dangerous condition. So they made it as safe as possible. So your hot lead of your house goes through the switch. After it goes through the single pole, double throw switch, you then enable the hot lead to the lamp. The return for the lamp is always there. That's what I think you're saying. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
Got another question here.
Yeah, stand by. Let Eric go this one first. Go ahead, Eric.
Okay, so the circuit that feeds the lamp, the neutral line doesn't necessarily have to go to the box where the switch is. Okay? And that's the way a lot of places wire, whereas actually they bring the pair of wires up to the light, they hook the neutral up to it, they, you know, if you have a piece of, say, Romex, you literally cut the neutral line open, screw that into the light, and that continues down to where the light switch is. So there is no neutral at the light switch box. Now, these dimmers have a little electronic circuit in it, which means you need some difference in voltage in order to make it work. And you're allowed to draw, don't quote me on this, there's a number, I don't remember whether it's 30 microamps or 3 milliamps, it's some really ridiculously known number. So they chose not to use a device like a TRIAC or an SCR to chop the incoming sine wave. Right? What they chose to do is they have a little, really what it is a monostable multivibrator that's connected to a knob. The output of the monostable multivibrator is essentially connected through a coil and a capacitor into the AC line. That in turn goes up to where the bulb is, and the LED supply sees that little pulse that's riding on the AC, and that determines what the brightness is. You got that much so far. K2YIW, K2YIW.
K-A-2-Y-H-Y.
As the man who's in the business, he's going to give us another point of view. So let me let Eric continue, then I'm going to go over to Steve, who's going to tell us the real world when it comes to lighting circuits. Go ahead, Eric, KE2EJ, K2LAW.
So what I'm getting at is that because you have this floating thing going on, any little spikes or disturbances that come in on the line, disturb the position of the pulse, which disturbs the position of the chip inside the LED, changing the brightness. There are a couple of different methods. This is just one. So turn it over to the gentleman in the business. I'm sure he can give you the exact detail on how they do it.
If I know Steve, his salt mine has solved this problem, and it's all going to go away. K-A-2-Y-H-Y, K-2-L-A-W. Go ahead, Steve.
You'll have to restate the question, Dick, but I jumped in because of the amount of allowed leakage current, either through ground, passing to ground, or passing through the old incandescent light bulbs, and the amount of leakage that you can go to ground is a half a milliamp, 500 microamps. Half a milliamp to ground, and if you use circuitry that could stay alive that much current, and charge capacitors to drive a relay or keep enough charge for a power supply, you can do it. And the reason for that is for two-wire dimming circuits or lighting controls, where you do not have the neutral in the switch box, which is the way things were from day one. But shortly we hope, the National Electrical Code will start requiring neutrals in switch boxes for precisely the reason that everyone wants all of these fancy lighting controls that can do all sorts of things with any kind of load, whether it be incandescent, fluorescent, LED, what have you. In order to get all of those features, you need more than a half a milliamp, so you need the neutral for the power supply. But restate the question, I'll give it a shot.
I'm gonna give you the question right now. Let me drop.
Let me throw it at him because I brought it up in the first place.
Go ahead, Eric.
We were actually, I had actually built my house with all the systems from the very beginning, and they're dimmable. And for a long time, because of the nature of that dimmer and only being able to draw the half a million, when you have the spikes and disturbances on the line, it disturbs the multivibrator and the dimmer itself, causing the light to flicker according to what's going on. Of course, when you don't have the dimmer in it, you don't have those problems. That's where we started talking about it.
And to give you a couple more words here, Steve, this all got started because we're talking about the compatibility of dimmer circuits with compact fluorescent light bulbs. And there's a whole series of compact fluorescent light bulbs that are and are not compatible with certain kinds of dimmer circuits. K-A-2-Y-H-Y, K-2-L-A-W in the tech net.
Oh, by the way, Dick, I forgot to mention, you don't see it in the compact fluorescent bulb because the phosphor itself has persistence.
Yeah, but that crazy power supply might not like certain kinds of dimmer circuits, is my guess. Steve, wait for the four beeps and you got it.
I think you're exactly right. And what it is the certain types of drivers for these LED lamps, and each one is a little bit different. There's many different ways to create a power supply for the LEDs, what they call them, drivers. And some dimmers work well with them and some do not. And this issue of flickering when the control range is usually at somewhere in the middle, one-third to two-thirds neighborhood, is a known phenomena, and it is specific to the type of dimmer. There are some dimmers that will do it. There are some dimmers that won't. And the problem is, again, the lack of the neutral in the switch box. If you have a neutral in the switch box, you've got plenty of power for the power supply to drive and dim the LED lamps. But when you're doing it from a two-wire, without the neutral in the switch box, where you have limited amount of power for the power supply, this issue issue of the flickering of the LEDs comes up. And it's more pronounced with, I'll use the word generically, cheaper dimmers than with more expensive dimmers. But it does happen. And it will even happen with the better dimmers in certain instances. But I'll tell you, Dick, the guy who really can explain what's happening in the power supply and what's getting starved and what's causing the flickering of the LEDs is Mark. And maybe we can get him to come over to the lunch and he'll give you the rest of the story. But that's as much as I know. But he designs those circuits, and his job was actually to eliminate the flicker with the LED.
D2OIS.
OIS now recognized. And this all got started because Barry was telling us about the compact fluorescent light bulbs. Some of them are upside down, some of them are right side up in his sockets, and he's getting at times a very decreased life compared to what's claimed by the manufacturer. I've also got one in my kitchen that's a compact fluorescent light mounted upside down. In other words, the coil is down and the socket is up, and I do get some peculiar characteristics where I think the bulb has failed because it won't light. I go up there to, with the socket turned on just to make sure it's making good contact, and I try to twist the bulb a little bit. I'm mechanically shaking it, and I'm reestablishing better contact by twisting it, and quite often it'll come back on and work for another month or two. So I get some crazy intermittents, and I think upside down mounting on some brand names is an aggravating factor. K2OYS. Start up with your name, sir, and then tell us your question or comment on these light bulbs. K2RIW, the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Yeah, Dick, it's Mark. KC2, Oscar, India, Sierra. Any event, when you have screw-in bulbs, LEDs, you're going to wind up using a CL-153 dimmer from Lutron. We can use the true dimmers from Legrand. These things work fairly well, but they do have to be dimmable bulbs. The not dimmable bulb's not going to work. And if you're using, I noticed problems with using recessed lights from contrast. They do not recommend using, they have special bulbs that they tell you you can use that could work with certain dimmers. So my suggestion to whoever it is that's doing this, I suggest call up technical support at the dimmer, whoever makes the dimmer, and if they've tested it with the manufacturer that they're using. Hold on one second. Let me drop it. So in the case of recess lights, I know contrast does not work very well. We do not. I work at a lighting store, so... You know, what they do is I do not sell the bulbs with those fixtures because they do flicker, whether they'll go on, there's problems, and they wind up to have to keep changing the transformers, which they really don't want to do. They do tell us that if you use an electronic transformer, you can use an LED bulb. Most of us like to sell magnetics because, we like the magnetic transformers better. And in that case, it would normally be an ELV-type dimmer, which you do need the dedicated and neutral, as you would need in, like, using my Lear electronic low-voltage track heads. You still need that. And by the way, in the city of New York, I believe they've made code that you have to use the ground wire attached to the box. I don't know why. But I guess to get more money out of everybody. So, that's my story. Have any other questions, please ask.
KD2HUC with a question.
Yeah. Gotta run, Dick. KA2YHY.
Steve, I'm pretty sure you said that the neutral has to be brought to the box really to make the dimmer circuit more reliable. To try to force a dimmer circuit to only require half a milliampere with no... the neutral in the box is really a tough way to go. Am I wrong with that impression, Steve? K2YHY, K2LAW.
The world of quality dimming will open up to you if you have the neutral in the switch box. Without it, you're relying upon a two-wire system, within the limitation of the half a milliamp for the power supply, which is permitted to leak to ground. And if the NEC goes the right way and requires neutral and switch boxes, then you'll see all sorts of fancy lighting controls start to come on the market, because you've got plenty of power for the power supplies to do all of these wonderful functions that everyone really wants. KA2YHY.
Thank you for coming on, Steve. And he works in the business. That's Steve number one. Here comes Steve number two, KD2HUC. Go right ahead with your question or comment, Steve number two. You got it. K2LAW.
Yeah, actually, Dick, my question was for the other Steve. So when you have it, when you're utilizing the controls, any type of electronic control, in a switch box that does not have a neutral, I was always under the impression that the control current was leaked through the actual fixture, either through the ballast of the, you know, if it was a fluorescent, or through the filament of an incandescent. Are you saying that it's actually allowed to leak to ground? Because, I mean, I've installed numerous, you know, amounts of these switches, and most of the houses on Long Island, you know, especially Nassau and whatnot, you know, ground wires don't even exist in those houses, and most of the metallic boxes are ungrounded. So, I mean, how is that handled? And I mean, is it noted whether or not these switches are required to be installed in a grounded box? Because trying to get a homeowner to you know, reroute wiring and whatnot when all they want is a switch change is not an easy task. Over to you, KD2HC.
I'm going to guess that that leakage we're talking about is into the circuit, not into ground. Let's see if Steve number one is still with us. KA2YHY, K2RHW. Go ahead, Steve, if you're still with us.
Yeah, leaking through the load, it was the first way it was done. And believe it or not, there, it goes up to about 3.5 milliamps, which is, I never liked it, but that's the way it was done. Through the load, and the precedent for that to be allowed was the old lighted toggle switches that had a neon bulb and a series resistor across the switch, so that when you turned the switch off, you had enough current limited by the resistor to ignite the neon. And that was the precedent that was used to allow the dimmers to leak current through the load in order to charge up capacitors to keep the power supplies. But that's the older way, although there's still some around to do that. But there was a big issue with that, with a story of an electrician who got knocked off the ladder when working on a fixture, when the switch was supposedly off, or the dimmer switch was supposedly off, but there was leakage through the load, and of course that particular worker did not turn off the circuit breaker, and just turned off the dimmer, and the leakage through the load is still 120 volts, limited current, but 3 milliamps enough to knock you right off the ladder, no questions asked, and that's what it did. And that brought that whole issue into discussion at National Electrical Code meetings. So it's an old story, but a lot of the newer two-wire dimmers will get their power by getting it to ground. But limited to only 0.5 milliampere. And while it's not the purest way of doing things, it is allowed. You know, the final solution once and for all is neutrals in all switch boxes. But, you know, that's going to...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
We did miss, Steve, the last 20 seconds of what you're saying, which you might want to repeat. And I believe, Steve, that you have a title, which means that you're part of the committee that's setting some of the rules for the National Electric Code. Is that true, or have I mixed that up a little bit? K2YHY, K2IW and TechNet, wait for the four beeps.
Yeah, that's true, Dick. And the last 20 seconds was the fact that the leakage through the load is an older way of, you know, getting more energy into the power supply for a two-wire type of lighting control. But the leakage to ground is the more down a while, but a lot shorter than leakage through the load, and that's the only way to get it with the two wire. And these and both of these systems are why you get problems with trying to dim compact fluorescents and LEDs, which is why you really need to match, like there was another gentleman who said, the exact lighting load, the type of LED bulb, the type of CFL bulb, to the exact dimmer. You just can't go out and put a regular dimmer and control any load you want. They really need to be matched. But the final solution, like I was saying, is when we get neutrals in all the switch boxes, then you'll see all sorts of fancy lighting controls with plenty of power to do all of the features that everyone wants.
And if I understand correctly, with that neutral at each box going to the dimmer circuit, so to speak, means that no longer will the dimmer circuit have to apply any current to the load in order to maintain its power supply. Therefore, that dimmer turned off, so to speak, is a hell of a lot safer to human safety. That man on the ladder you talked about being hit with that current, and I guess we're supposed to keep the current under half a milliamp primarily for human safety, if I understand correctly. Over to you, Steve, for number one, KE2YHY.
A half a milliamp, Dick, is leakage to ground. That's the limitation set by Underwriters Laboratories, and that's what a lot of the lighting controls will do very low power requirement electronics. The other one, leaking through the load, that was up as high as 3.5, but usually around 2.5 milliamperes, and that's the one that knocked the guy off the ladder. But understand, that's because that person neglected to turn off the circuit breaker and decided to work by simply turning off the dimmer switch, which you would think is going to open up the hot line. But when you have this series bleeding of current, or the same thing would have happened with an old neon ordinary on and off switch, illuminated toggle switch that had a neon, that when you turn off the switch, the neon is on, and that's going through the load as well. So you really still have 120 volts and a few milliamps available with that air gap switch open. But across that air gap, you've got a neon lamp and a couple kilo ohms of resistance to limit the current.
Leakage to ground strikes me in a mysterious way here, Steve. If I've got a not-so-nice junction box, a switch box, which has no local neutral, you know, has nothing but the hot lead, and it's going to complete that circuit when you flip that switch. And if I'm putting a dimmer in that box, there is no local ground. So how can my dimmer have half a milliamp of leakage to ground? There is no ground there. The only connection it has is to the hot lead and to the load. Over to you, Steve, K2LIW.
Then you've got an issue. It's not going to work. You can't get the power supply current.
OAS.
Okay, Mark's going to straighten this all out on this one. K2OIS. K2IW. Go ahead, Mark.
I'm going to straighten out, but I know the electricians, what they do is they take the, they buy in like an ELV type dimmer, and they take the dedicated neutral, and they bring it back to the ground, and it works. I don't know how safe it is. I don't know if it's up to code, but I'll tell you, I remember I used to fix ceiling fans, and there'd be times I go up to the touch the housing on the fan, and the thing would be, I'd be getting, shocked. Not to knock me off the ladder, but enough to make me tingle. So I don't know if it's safe. I don't know if it's allowed. Maybe the other gentleman that works with the codes, he may know. I don't know that. I'm not an electrician, but I do work in the lighting store.
Yeah, my understanding is that if you're doing a good job, essentially no current should be flowing to that ground, that third lead, the round pin on your plug, if you know what I mean. That's supposed to be there for safety, not for current return. your neutral is supposed to be the current return, is my understanding. Let's see if I've got that right or wrong. K-A-2-Y-H-Y, K-2-I-W in the tech net.
100% correct, Dick, but the limitation on what an appliance can leak to ground is set at a half a milliamp. And it's really meant for sort of capacitive leakage and any stray leakage that you might have in a product, but it should normally be zero. But of course, nothing is at zero, so you've got to put an absolute number on it, and the underwriters set that at half a milliamp.
In the case of a hospital environment where a person is being catheterized, and they're depending on that so-called safety wiring, I'm going to call it, at ground, to make sure that there is no potential difference between the patient and the instrumentation, and that catheter might contain a saline solution that's highly conductive, and if that catheter is going near the person's coronary system, an extremely small amount of current can send you into fibrillation. So there have been stories of somebody turning on a vacuum cleaner three rooms away, and a fault in the vacuum cleaner was pouring current into that that safety ground. Therefore, the safety ground was not at zero potential. It was at some other potential, creating a current flow through the catheter, through the coronary system of the patient, and therefore could create a lot of grief. So I think this is part of the reason why, if everything is right, no current should be flowing into that that safety ground, as I call it. Anybody with any further comments on all of the above, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
A2YHY.
You got it, Steve, number two. I'll wait for the beeps.
Hospitals and healthcare facilities is a whole other story, Dick. And in most hospital and healthcare facilities where you have invasive type catheters, like in an operating room or an emergency room, there's a whole different type of set of rules that apply, where you have isolation systems, patient isolation systems, and I know for a lot of products that that are used in ORs and ERs, that leakage current that I told you for ordinary homeowner type products at a half a milliamp, when the product is designed to go into those environments, the leakage current limitation is 100 microamperes.
Now, hopefully all of that instrumentation in a hospital, particularly in the cath lab, is double insulated, isolation transformers, and whatever. So are you telling me that in the hospital environment, 100 microamps is allowed to flow into that grounding safety system? Over to you, Steve, K2LIW.
Yes, but there are really two dead metal grounding safety systems. The one that's on the structure of the building and where most dead metal is connected, and then the one that's on that stainless steel table in the operating room. Totally different, not connected to the other earth ground system. That's through your isolation system, the patient isolation system. And there's a whole industry created around these isolation systems that make sure, or at least are supposed to make sure, that the dead metal in the OR and ERs is not the same as the dead metal you might find out in the cafeteria of a hospital.
Now, in the old days, when I was, for a short period of time, brought as a consultant into Downstate Medical Center in Brooklyn, for a short period of time, when the electrosurgical unit called the Bovie machine was being used, I believe the patient was literally put onto a small piece of metal called the butt plate, was the slang we used for it, to make sure there was no floating electrostatic potential on the patient. Grounding of the patient and grounding of the instrumentation, I suspect, is a... I'd like to believe that that's continuously being updated because there's all kinds of safety concerns there, I think. K-A-2-Y-H-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Well, for most homes and businesses, you have the National Electrical Code, which is NFPA 70, and that governs these types of things that we're talking about, except when you go into a hospital or healthcare facility, there's a whole other code book called NFPA 99, which, along with one chapter out of the NEC, governs how those things are done. And it's there is quite a lot, Dick, on the issue with leakage currents, where you have invasive procedures going on. I'm not 100% up to speed on all of those, but I know where to go to find the numbers, and I know the 100 microamp is what's out there. But that's even high when you're talking about invasives, and that's why they have the patient isolation systems. But we're a long way from dimmers, but someday a neutral in every switch box and a chicken in every pot. 7-3, Dick, gotta run. K-A-2-Y-H-Y.
I think you're saying that the later codes you're predicting are going to essentially force a neutral to be present in every switch box. That really is the right way to do it. Isn't that true, Steve?
Absolutely. And the rule did get into the last code, which is what we're working with now, the 2014. But unfortunately, there was a loophole in it that most building contractors take advantage of to get around putting it in there. The intention was well intended, but the only way the rule got in is to leave the loophole. And of course, everyone's taking advantage of the loophole. But eventually the loophole will come out. And maybe tomorrow, Dick, I'll look it up and I'll give you a chapter and verse on that loophole. But it is in the code now, but it's sort of wishy-washy and there's a way around it. K-A-2-Y-H-Y.
Thank you very much, Steve. Awful glad you stepped in and set us straight on some of these and some of these issues. Anyone have any further? This question all got started by Barry asking us about compact fluorescent light bulbs that were giving him some grief of not giving the right amount of life, giving some intermittency, and working poorly with dimmer circuits. But we electronic mavens, because we know RF circuitry, which is, of course, the king of electronics, is wireless circuitry, and therefore simple 60-cycle power wiring. I mean, that's a couple steps below us, so to speak. So we think we're experts on that. I doubt it. You got to be careful, particularly if you're putting 220-volt wiring in the shack because you want to run a kilowatt power amplifier, if you know what I mean. You got to be careful. And with any further questions and comments on all of the above, give me a call with us right now, K2LAW, the Tech Man.
I'm going to bring up the next part of that question next week. I think I've done enough damage for the night. But I wrote it down, and next week you'll hear from me again in 2MB.
Looking forward to it, Barry. Here's a guy who can run high enough RF power output that he can send a signal to the moon, hear his own echoes come back, and talk to people throughout the world. You've done that. And that requires some pretty good wiring in a house in Far Rockaway. And the house was probably built, I'm going to make a guess, your house was built in 1920 or so. And therefore, I'll bet you've had to do some updating of the wiring of your house in order to get the raw energy to do that. Am I even close to correct on that one, Barry? N2MB, K2LAW.
This house has been rewired for the third time now. When the house was first built, it didn't even have electricity. It had gas lights. We've come a long ways. And by the way, that was 1910.
Wow. I'm impressed. And I've been there. I didn't realize that you have an official antique house. In other words, it's got classified as a, what's the word for it now? A historic monument. Your house could almost be declared a historic monument, Barry. Go ahead.
I think the plumbing could be. You know, the gas light pipes are still coming out of the ceiling downstairs. Just one spot. Just one place. We never took it away. I think we just left it there because it was there and it was kind of cute, you know?
And you could always use it as an attachment point for an antenna or a local ground if it's still connected to Earth or whatever. Fun stuff. We've kept poor old John waiting an awful long time. Hope he's still with us. KC2SHO, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
No worries at all, guys. Yeah, I'm here for the duration, so no big deal. And I don't have a specific question this evening, but what I do have is some comment that might lead to further discussion, whether that's tonight or next week. K2RIW, KC2SHO.
Okay, you've whet our appetite, you've got our curiosity. Go ahead with your comment, John. Wait for the beeps.
All right, well, I hope I'm not doubling up on something that's already been brought up. I, unfortunately, last week just completely forgot to tune in to the TechNet and woke up Monday morning thinking, oh, boy, there was something I was supposed to be doing last night. I had that feeling I was supposed to be doing something all evening, but obviously that didn't happen. So anyway, real quick, recently came to my attention that there was a Ham Radio Now episode, number 199, where... they referenced a video of a gentleman by the name of Bill Hayes, AE4QL, who does a demonstration with a lot of visual aids on standing waves, and it is called Standing Up for Standing Waves. I'm wondering if you've seen that video, K2RIW, KC2SHO.
Guess you're coming in by EchoLink or IRLP. You've got a different set of peeps there, John. I probably have not seen that one. You're going to give us the URL by which we can get to it. And when it comes to standing waves, it's one of the subjects that there's never enough discussion on it. Amateurs have got so darn many, I'm going to be kind of severe on this one, old wives' tales beliefs on standing waves. There are a substantial number of amateurs who believe that there isn't an exact number of wavelengths of transmission line between your transmitter and the antenna, between your standing wave ratio sensing equipment and the antenna, between the bird watt meter and the antenna, that if there isn't some exact number of wavelengths, that the system is not going to work correctly. Corresponding to that, there are people who think that if you choose the magic length of cable, that standing wave ratio will disappear. We've done an awful lot to try to dispel an awful lot of these crazy rumors, and I've spent the last 10 years of my life working on extremely low standing wave ratio equipment. In other words, I've got my name is on over 30 patent applications for fancy antennas that have standing wave ratio of 1.05 to 1 or better across a 3% bandwidth of 902 to 928 megacycles. There's a whole art and science building extremely low standing wave ratio antennas. That's a whole area, let me drop, that hasn't been properly addressed, made clear. I mean, where the standing wave ratio is coming from, how you can correct it, what good would a ballon do, a stub do, an antenna tuner at the antenna, an antenna tuner, a shack, where does the reflected power coming back to the antenna tuner, where does it go, does the antenna tuner just throw it away? All kinds of theories on this one. And so we can never have enough discussion. There are guys who are putting zillions of egg insulators into their guy wires to make sure the guy wires are not going to be resonant because they think it's going to make the antennas fail. Oh, boy, people are losing an awful lot of sleep over these issues. So there's never enough discussion on this because how that magic amount of RF your transmitter creates goes down that transmission line and ends up at the antenna, and hopefully most of it stays there. What you've got to do to make that happen, and how bad is it when it's not that good? I mean, there are people who think that a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio is going to make the whole system explode. Let me drop. In reality, a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio means in the worst case, you lose half a dB of your transmitted power. In the worst case, half a dB for a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. Yes, some of these persnickety 80 through 10 meter no-tune rigs these days will start going into the self-protect mode, cutting themselves back if you have anything over a 1.5 in some cases. And that's just overly critical circuitry put in those transmitters, forcing you to buy or make sure installed there is an automatic antenna tuner, because very few of us are always going to have less than 1.5 standing wave ratio on all of our antennas across all of the bands that we use. So so that's a unreasonable requirement from my point of view. Give us a couple of words as to what you saw in that YouTube video on the standing wave ratio. And as you probably know, a good buddy of mine, Walt Maxwell, W2DU, wrote a whole series of articles in QST Magazine that were entitled Reflections on Reflections. And I believe they've packaged almost all of his articles into a separate book you can buy from ARRL, from Walt, that tries to make this subject clearer. Very few of the amateurs, very few of the electronic engineers I know can answer my couple of puzzle questions. I've got a couple of... Let me drop. As a hobby, I collect physics puzzles that are educational. And I can take a couple of my standing wave ratio physics puzzle questions, give them to my 10 and 20, 25-year experienced electronic engineers, and a high percentage of them don't know what's going on, if you know what I mean. The classic one is that I've got a 50-ohm capacitive reactance at the end of a cable. I put a 50-ohm, I put a, the right-size capacitor in this frequency that is exactly a 50-ohm load, 50-ohm capacitive load. What's the standing wave ratio on that system? My goodness, do I get crazy answers on that one. Over to you, John. Tell us a little bit about what you think of this YouTube video. Does it make it clearer? KC2SHO, K2LAW, the TechNet.
K2RIW, KC2SHO. Yeah, Dick, this has been a really good video. It's been going around the group here with the, local group of amateurs here that we typically communicate with. And a lot of comment, a lot of good things. It's an hour and 45 minutes of a demonstration on an open line. Of course, all the demonstrations port almost identically over to a transmission line. So it's hard to sum it up very quickly, but I think it's something that everybody should see. There is one error in the video that we discovered, and Bill Hayes said he would change his his presentation a little bit to fix that, but that's a very minor thing, which doesn't affect what he's trying to portray at all. And it is an amazing video. I couldn't possibly sum it up. It really gives you a full idea of what's going on in your transmission line in every situation. And it's a bit misleading because saying it's only standing waves demonstrated is not enough. He does so much more. He even demonstrates some inner mod by just rubbing some pipes together in the transmission path. It's very, very good. It's very visual because instead of meters and looking at actual values on meters typically, he has light bulbs on his forward, his reflected, his current, and his voltage probes. So the brightness of the bulbs pour very well over to a visual presentation. And if you search for Ham Radio Now from Google, it will bring you to a website called arvideonews.com. And it's the second link down at the moment, episode 199, Standing Up for Standing Waves.
You're fine, John. Sounds like it's worth looking for. A little bit disappointed that it's an hour and a half or something like that, what you said. Some people are going to be put off by entering a YouTube video that's that long. Some people will be put off by that if they know it ahead of time. By the way, if you go to QRZ.com and you look up KC2SHO, you'll be amazed at the pictures of his shack. real good looking. And so... That's quite a system you got there in Mount Laurel, New Jersey. And because you're in New Jersey, I guess that's the reason you're coming through by EchoLink as opposed to talking to us directly. You're glad to hear that, and sounds like you've corrected the minor error. And I presume you work in the RF world as an occupation in order to have the basic knowledge about what's going on with transmission lines and standing wave ratio and why you were able to find the error in that video. I'm making some guesses and you're going to correct me on that one, John. Other than people who work with radio, very few people have got a good understanding of transmission lines and standing wave ratio in particular that goes on. Every transmission line has got standing wave ratio. And we have to discuss how much. Is your reflected signal at 10 dB down, which is roughly a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, or is it 40 dB down, which means you've got almost a perfect match? And there are times when you definitely need that. In the case of, let me drop it. In the case of the antenna that's connected onto a handheld reader that's called an RFID interrogator, radio frequency identification circuit interrogator, you would like the reflection coefficient on that antenna to be minus 30 dB if you can get it. So where did your knowledge on this subject come from, John? KC2SHO, K2RIW, the TechNet.
K2RIW, KC2SHO, thank you for the kudos. Check will be in the mail, as I've often heard you say. I have, probably over 12 years of broadcast RF experience, and it's been a very big personal interest of mine as well. And since departing from the broadcast world, I've been doing two-way radio. Still doing that right now. And yeah, the video is it's quite long, but it's really worth it. And he is a little slow because he gives you time, and he's interacting with an audience, so it's not. It could be done a lot quicker, you know, if it was without an audience. But the audience is answering, participating a bit. He's asking questions, querying the audience. But it really is worth the time. Grab your favorite beverage, sit down, and be prepared, I think, to see the most comprehensive video I've ever seen on the subject, with a very good visual. Very good visual aids, very well done, very well thought out. He spent a lot of time putting this kit together. The kit alone is the most impressive piece, and I would love to build something like that to hopefully show to younger people and students, maybe pass on some knowledge. And I cannot claim to be the one who actually found the error. It was another gentleman that I speak with regularly, so we have to give him credit. That would be K3WWT would be the gentleman who found that. K2RIW, KC2SHO.
Question, we'll pick you up in a second. If it was television broadcast, I know you're into broadcast, John, if it was television broadcast, there the antenna has to be very low in standing wave ratio. Because even if you've got an antenna tuner, so to speak, at the transmitter, and you can correct the VSWR, that is not good enough for television broadcast, because when you do an antenna tuner correction in the shack, that doesn't affect at all the standing wave ratio that's on the transmission line. That only lowers the standing wave ratio as seen by the transmitter. The transmission line still has that signal reflecting back and forth. In the case of transmitting video, that reflected signal gives you a group delay. It gives you a delayed signal that creates ghosts on the screen back in the analog days. In the case of the digital days, the equivalent of ghost becomes less and less tolerable. Eventually, you're creating a bit error rate right at the transmitter that's going to give grief to those poor television over-the-air digital receivers that are trying to get that signal. Let me drop. And when it comes to real good YouTube videos, you're indicating one from Bill Hayes. There's a whole series of them that are very well done by a guy named Derek Mueller. They're under the label of Viatasium. He's a scientist from Australia that has made about 50 or so real good science videos on the YouTube video. If you simply Google the word Viatasium, V-I-A-T-A-S-I-U-M, I think it is, and very good science. The best one he has recently is on the subject of nuclear radiation. He took a real good Geiger counter and went to all the hot spots in the world to measure what spot in the world has the highest nuclear radiation. And the end of that video is an extremely surprising conclusion that you never would have guessed. Another very good YouTube video are the ones that were done by Walter Lewin, the physics professor at Microwave Institute of Massachusetts Institute of Technology. I want to call it Microwave, MIT. Walter Lewin, he recently retired, but that was a physics professor. And what all these guys are doing, I'm guessing both Hayes and Lewin and Bueller, let me drop it. What they're really doing that's of great value is to realize that you make the greatest impact on a student if you show him the real video, if you show him the real hardware under the measurement operation. I mean, it's fine to have lofty words and write fancy equations on the board and manipulate those equations, but when you take the concept you're trying to teach, and now in front of that class you've got real electronic test equipment, so to speak, and you watch the light change in intensity or in the chrominance, you watch the display on the oscilloscope screen, you watch the change on the picture on the television screen or any other kind of display, when you see the real hardware doing it, the action, you see the result. And that has a heck of a lot more impact. It becomes real. And so that's what I think is going on here. The person who just wanted to give us a further question or comment, who was that? Give me your full call, let us a name. K2RIW, the tech nest.
Roger, this is K1MJM, mic number 2. I was just wondering some more details, how I can find that. I'll put a link to it on the website.
Okay, we have our former broadcast engineer right here who's going to give us the information right now. So, John, tell mic number 2, and mic number 2, by the way, is the website you can go to which gives you additional information backing up the TechNet. That website of mic number 2, K1MJM, is limontechnet.com, and you'll find some nice information there. And so that exact URL to get to Bill Hayes' YouTube video, you're going to repeat that for us, John. KC2SHO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, good evening, and thank you for doing what you do there with the website. That's awesome. I have frequented that and looked up many of the audio clips and listened to some past content. Thank you for hosting that. The name of the website is kind of long, but it is arvideonews.com/HRN for Ham Radio Now. And that will bring you to the Ham Radio Now page. I also posted it to the Leemark Facebook page just a bit ago, a few minutes ago. So if you have access to the Leemark Facebook page, you'll see that I just posted that, which will get you there. It will get you right to the YouTube video, which might be a little more direct.
In some cases, when you've got a very long URL, what I've been able to do on certain occasions is tell people that if you do a Google search, and if you use these two words as a search word, or in other words, to try to find that YouTube video on Valiant Veritasium by Derek Mueller on the subject of nuclear radiation testing at various points in the world. It's got a great big long URL, but if you simply Google search the word Viatasium and radiation, you'll find it very fast. And so you said Leemark. We're not quite sure. We know what Leemark is, but you said Leemark. And so give us the spelling of that and make off that. Okay, he found it. So looks like he found it. We don't have to repeat that. Well done. Anybody with any further questions or comments on the subject, give me a call. That is right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Delta 2, Alpha Victor Uniform.
Mr. Alpha Victor Uniform, give me that call letter again. Start with your name and go right ahead with your question or comment on the subject.
My call is Kilo Delta 2, Alpha Victor Uniform. Name is Tim. Good evening, Dick.
Okay, do you have a comment or a question on this subject? Kim, go ahead.
Say, Dick, it's Tim, T-I-M, Tango India Mike, and there's an article in this the very recent issue of QST was demonstrating, you know, the differences between open wire transmission line, ladder line, and coax. it's a very good read. And I'm reading the book called Reflections, Transmission Lines and Antennas, written by, let me see, Walter Maxwell, W2DU, at the same time. So I thought this topic is very interesting. Over.
very fine, Tim. That's the man I mentioned earlier, W2DU, had the whole series of articles in QST called Reflections on Reflections. What Tim is now bringing to our attention is the latest issue of QST, the June issue, starting on page 30, has an article on balance and open